The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Via Zoom, Dr. Euphemia Burke-Robinson, who's here to talk about her new book. Would like to welcome you. Good morning and welcome. How are you?
Good morning. It's a lot because you would have heard of what happened to Jamaica.
Yes.
Aside of that, I am in good spirit. You have to maintain that so that you can weather the storms, and no pun intended there.
Well, I'm looking at the resilience of the Jamaican people as well, and it's a bright example to the rest of us. For those who, I mean, you know that Trinidad and Tobago, and I would think CARICOM and the wider Caribbean, we in an anxiety-caused mental state at the moment, you know, with what's happening with Venezuela and not wanting to see war enter our region as well. So, girl, we in it together. Don't worry.
These are unprecedented times.
Unprecedented times.
We were made for this.
Mm-hmm. So we will show them, the rest of the world, how we deal with these things. So welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You've already established that you are Jamaican, born, bred and strong. Yes. Tell us a little bit about how you started writing. What was the spark? You know, who is Dr. Robinson?
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. All right. So I am an education officer working in Jamaica, where I supervise the schools, and that is an honor for me, as it came right in line with why I became an educator, because as a student, I struggled with reading, just the thing that people do naturally, read. It took me quite some time to acquire that skill. And so when I did acquire the skill, and when I looked on all the things that my teachers had to do to help me to move from where I was to where I am, I became an educator. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's good for me. And I grew up in rural Jamaica, very rural to the point where, if I could paint a picture for you, we didn't have piped water. We didn't, most families, myself included, we didn't have electricity. We grew up with what we call in Jamaica the home sweet home lamp.
Is that the conical vase with the oil to the bottom with the wick?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the dial at the side. Yep. Yep.
Yes. Yes. And where I grew up, it was mostly farming. Our parents did quite a bit of farming so that we could sustain the family, because, of course, otherwise, you know, we couldn't sustain ourselves with things that we had to buy. So we were, to be honest, self-sustained in what it is that we had on the farm. Mm-hmm. And so that is how we grew up. I grew up in a community that was very close-knitted. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody protected everybody, especially the children. And so I grew up in a space where the community owned the children, you know. So when you did well, everybody knew you were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you didn't do well, guess what?
Everybody knew too.
But
everybody knew.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it was close-knitted, whereby you were everybody's children, and you were just corrected by all the adults. They corrected you, so you couldn't get out of line. And because you were not home, you think that, you know, you would get away with it. So mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so the school was really our anchor, along with the church. You know, I grew up in the Methodist church, and that also forms a part of my compass even today. I am still with the Methodist Church. So that, in a nutshell, is who I am.
And this would be your first book. Have you stepped into other genres?
Thank you so much. So this is my first book, and it came out of the idea that I have been sharing especially in my vocation as an educator, about just the ability to learn to read and the importance of learning to read. Because for me, when I did learn to read, it was 11, going 12 when I learned to spell my name. And it was like coming into light, moving out of darkness. And so I would share my story, and individuals would say, no, you know, look at you now. This story could inspire others. And so out of that kind of nudging, I was able to put it together. And I realized that, you know, it is having that impact where not just for students who can't read, but all the other things that are in the story, how it is nestled in resilience, how it is nestled in humor, you know, it has served for that kind of inspiration, for that kind of good read for others. So it is really my first publication like that.
Like this. Now, in your research as an educator, our way in which of dealing with learning abilities amongst children, do you see that as the issue, part of the issue, or something that we need to pay attention to more, address in a different way? What's your thoughts on that?
All right. So as I'm going to make reference to my own experience, when I look back as to what were some of the things that caused me to have been a late bloomer, very late bloomer, was one of the things was my home environment. When I look in my home, there wasn't anything there to stimulate, you know, hardly anything there to stimulate this emergent literacy that we have now. So there weren't any books other than just the piece that we would get to go to school. We had the exercise book, and I couldn't, my parents couldn't afford to give me one. They would cut one for myself and my sibling so that I could get a little half, and the other my other siblings got half. So there weren't any books in the environment. We didn't have any television, any radio. So the environment itself was not liberating in that way, and it was insufficient. Another thing was that I didn't see my parents reading, because even now my mother still can't read. So the environment was also something that weighed heavily on my inability to master the skill. As it relates now to how to school, I developed a fear for this thing called reading. And because of how it was approached at that time, where by if you can't, then you would be subjected to some kind of punishment. If it is that you were to do spellings and you didn't get the words correct, you may be subjected to some kind of a punishment at that
or
time.
Or ridiculed by not only the children, but the teachers.
So punishment, and just the fact that you can't read and you're called upon. For me, everywhere that could sweat did sweat, you know, and I would do other things to distract the teacher, to get out of the space. But now, as we look on those kind of things, I realize that we have evolved in how it is that we cater to these kind of things. And so students are really catered to, for the most part, with their developmental level. And the strategies that are used now, they would, more than anything else, would give the students the ability, other than create this kind of endurance for the student to try. So I think that we have evolved and we have improved in how it is that we are deliberate, and how it is that we have pulled out literacy as a discipline by itself, and are treating with it outside of just approaching it from a sense that is mixed with everything else. And I think that that augurs for how it is that we are improving literacy in a bigger way. Though we still have pockets of illiteracy and just the disability to read, we have come a far way.
Now, a few points brought up well within your response. And one of the questions, as an educator and developing this book, do you think that curriculum, or the plural of curriculum is curriculi, right? That
is
that is taught in the different countries, not only Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, but the Caribbean on a whole, do you think that that curriculum really gives our children the foundation it needs to survive, not only in the Caribbean, but on the wider spectrum of the world?
So I think so. And let me tell you why I think that is the case. Number one, we have gotten smaller. And so our educators now, they have information, certainly instructional information that they can pull from a variety of sources that they can bring to bear and tailor to their local context. So that in itself would improve on how it is that we do literacy, we do instruction to enable our students to be able to read and not just call words, but to come with a level of comprehension and to be able to decode and all of those things surrounding literacy. So the access to resources and to what I deem to be exemplary strategies, they abound in the fact that we have the different sources. We have the internet now that we can look to see what's happening outside of the Caribbean, in the North America, in Europe, what they're doing. And so educators can tailor that. Those who are designing and developing curriculum, they can look on those, and not just to take in a wholesome way, but they can look on how it is that those have been implemented and see what can work for the local context and what, you know, they wouldn't need, and what they can develop on what we already have. So I think that just the space alone and just the prevalence of the information, and just how it is that educators can get to network and study best practices, I think that just the environment is ripe for how it is that we can improve this.
So just looking at the synopsis of your book, Most Improved Student in the Classroom of Life, every student enters the learning environment with greatness parceled inside, a potential waiting to be nurtured. It takes the sacrifice, willingness, and creative spirit of a great teacher to unlock that hidden promise. The Most Improved Student is a reliable, empowering, and motivational story of a young Jamaican girl who, despite the odds, adversities, and challenges of poverty, triumphed over her struggles to learn to read. Her transformation and self-development, both academic and personal, was fueled by the unwavering commitment and dedication of a phenomenal teacher who believed in her and chose to invest time, energy, effort, and a thoughtful approach to her development and overall success. Set against the vibrant backdrop of rural Jamaica in the 1980s, the story explores the themes of resilience, humility, resourcefulness, and camaraderie, and the enduring community spirit that defines so many childhoods in similar settings. It is a celebration of determination, self-belief, and the power of a teacher's influence to spark the flame of achievement, success, and ultimately greatness. This winning formula for overcoming failure, illustrated through the journey of a young girl, is a must-read for every teacher committed to transforming and motivating students. Additionally, it serves as a source book for the students' self-development and a powerful roadmap for rising above failure and underperformance to achieve meaningful, life-changing success. So definitely this can be applied to any classroom, especially if a teacher sees potential in many of her students and trying to figure out, how do I take that raw talent, that raw material that I see before me, and actually mold it into something? Are there going to be follow-ups to this? Because it would be, well, from the cover, I'm seeing like a primary school setting. Is there one for secondary school and then one for university? Because they're, I mean, it's different stages, different environments, as you said before.
Yes, most certainly. So that is part one of the many part series. You know, certainly others are, persons who have read are saying that, look, I am looking for more. It can't just stop here, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I am, you know, just building out
Dr. Robinson?
Part two of how it is that I was able to apply myself at the secondary level, mm-hmm. so that I was successful in the CSEC examinations. So so that is the other part of what will come in the series.
I mean, you've made it all the way to doctorate, so I'm sure that those journeys would be something to take in, especially as many young students who are looking for that inspiration, regardless of how many of our how we see young people these days. There are many that are still locking out the noise and really focusing on getting to success, whatever that success means for them. And they themselves probably looking for some motivational piece to get them to that point.
Yes, and let me tell you, the book is doing that, but what was very profound for me was not just our students are, you know, feeling inspired, having read the book, but the teachers in Jamaica here. Mm-hmm. I am getting an overwhelming feedback, positive feedback from the teachers who were saying that, look, the strategies that this teacher used at the time and how it is that she inspired you. Because my teacher, if you know, as described in the book, she had a microphone in her throat, mm-hmm. you know. She had supersonic hearing because she could hear anybody speak and know that this was Euphemia making trouble, you know. Mm. And it was just so profound, and how she took the time out to know the students so that she could treat with them on an individual level, in how it is that she caters to their individual needs. Mm-hmm. So that they can give their best, so that they could, you know, evolve. And that for me is really what caused that turn in how it is that I perceive school. Because the truth is, I didn't love school. I hated school. I hated
many
school
of us. what was the point? Yeah, when we're going through the process, it's like, oh gosh, no. But, yeah.
So here we go again. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to ask me to read, mm-hmm. you know. Somebody's going to ask me to spell a word, and I can't do it. And you know you can't do it, and you're going to be ridiculed by those who can. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the way in which classrooms are set up now,
yes. mm-hmm.
do you think changing that environment would help with children being more receptive to being in school and learning? There have been a few experiments that have changed the environment. What do you think about that?
I think that the way that we certainly in Jamaica, mm-hmm. we move students based on age, right? And sometimes their maturity, certainly the cognitive maturity, is not in alignment with their the chronological age. And so when students move like that, sometimes it's very it's discouraging when they are not able to match up with their peers. And so if it is that we take the time out to treat with students based on where they are, so that they can be stimulated, they are not intimidated, and they don't get that fear, but they feel comfortable, and they get to work based on where they are. I think that would augur better, mm-hmm. for students in how it is that they get to own their learning, own their develop the their metacognitive skills, and be able to charter their own learning paths, mm-hmm. as opposed to being in a space where they feel as though they are worthless, they are not good for anything, because they see persons moving along and they are just there feeling stifled. So if it is that we create a design that would give the students that space to treat with their cognitive development outside of just the chronological development, then I think that would better serve mm-hmm. students.
Because there are some children that would love to read and write, and then there are others who would like to pick up paintbrushes and hammers.
Differently stimulated.
Yeah. And those who are electrically inclined to take apart a radio and build it back again. And
that is the thing. So the one fit all, it doesn't work. Because how would I feel when I'm in school? I love to paint. That's where I shine. Mm-hmm. And then for the entire day, I'm in school and I didn't get a chance to pick up a crayon. Why do I go back next day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the reason I go to school, to shine. And I go to school to shine because I get to pick up a crayon. Now, I would rather stay home and pick up one because I get to shine that way. Mm-hmm. You know? So us catering to the different intelligences and the different things that stimulate the learners. And that's why it's so important for us to know our learners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just their superficial knowing, but a deep knowing of the students so that we can properly cater to their needs.
Is there a sense of assessments that are needed when children are entering school? Yes, there is a system, I'm speaking from Trinidad and Tobago's perspective, where they do an entrance exam and you see where the child is recognizing. Okay, so within the last couple of years, the acknowledgement of abilities, because I don't like the word disabilities, really and truly. Autism, slower learning, that kind of thing. These assessments, do you think it needs to be more rigorous? Should we demand them now as we enter the children into the school system? Because that can solve a lot of problems or at least alert us to those issues before just putting them in, as you say, the one size fits all.
Right. So I think that those exams has merit, because what it does, it helps the teachers to cater to the students' academic needs and to treat with them where they are.
Mm-hmm. We lost you for a couple of seconds there. Can you repeat what you just said? We lost you for a couple of seconds.
Okay. No. Right. So I was saying that those assessments certainly do have merit. Are you hearing me now?
Yes, loud and clear.
Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, good. Right. But what I'm thinking is that for us to properly know our students, there would be need for more in terms of an audit. So when I come into your space, you should get to understand my interest, not just where I am academically, but you should have information about what are the things that I love to do, what are the things that stimulate me, because maybe those are the drivers that you're going to be capitalizing on to get to me and to get to stimulate me in the other academic areas.
Mm-hmm.
So do I love to dance? You don't know. And so you may very well design for me plans that don't include dancing at all. You know, do I love poetry? Do I love to read? Do I love to sing? Can I sing? Mm-hmm. You know, so an audit of the students and not just what we can turn out in terms of the math and the language, you know, but a comprehensive audit of the student, mm-hmm. their interest, so that we can properly cater and place. And if it is that is going to be making a determination as to where I am, I'm sent to be treated with, then that should help to determine where I access education, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
because you understand my interest and those can be used as the vehicle to get to stimulate me in probably other areas that I'm not so stimulated.
And then from all of those assessments, then we can think about the cost. Now, the rural part of any island, that is an issue, especially when family members or persons really want to have their children educated. How much or how does government assistance should play a role in providing these facilities and or methods of ensuring that all children receive the education that is necessary?
You know, I have always battled with this idea because I firmly believe that education more than anything else is what can move a people. Mm-hmm. And I know and I'm convinced that education and what it does, it is that it caters to the workforce of the country, mm-hmm. to the human resource. And I think that that is the greatest resource a country can have. And so I think that the biggest portion of every budget should be leveled in education, and not just at any one point, but it should speak to equity and treating with the students' education even before they emerge in the formal setting, so that we cater to education from students are on the breast until they are ready for the workforce. Mm-hmm. And so what it takes is for us to have the political will to ensure that we build out properly from a financial, from the finances and what all the resources that are needed, so that we properly cater to.
Well, we lost you for 2 seconds
side
there.
Of that, we are going to have the struggle. We're going to continue to have the struggles. Sufficient resource, square education, so that the human resource of a country can be so fortified. Mm. And that is the bottom line.
Dr. Robinson, I know that with the system as it is now after Hurricane Melissa, I know that the Wi-Fi is a bit, you know, in and out, but we got the gist of what you were saying. On that note, how is everything with cleanup, restoring process in Jamaica? Can you quickly tell us or give us an update as to what's happening?
Sure. Now, we know that we experienced the brunt of the hurricane on Wednesday of last week. Mm-hmm. And on Thursday, we got to work. And it's not just from the government-led operations, but a big portion of Jamaica, you know, we all suffered, mm-hmm. but some of us saw more than others. And so we put our boots on and we went to the western part of Jamaica, down in St. Elizabeth, mm-hmm. Westmoreland, St. James, Trelawney, and we have started the recovery, the road to recovery. Now, if you talk to anybody in Kingston or in St. Catherine, we would have gone down. For me personally, I would have gone down to Westmoreland with goods and, you know, just to help with persons who are so depraved at this time because of the hurricane. Mm-hmm. But for certain, every single Jamaican who can, and our private companies and government, we have started the process. And so while it is going to be a long journey, the truth is that we have started. We would have got a good perspective of what the damages are. It is grave, I must tell you. But mm-hmm. what we know to be true is that we feel that with all the help that we're getting, and might I say thanks to the different countries, mm-hmm. to all the persons who have put their efforts behind getting us back on track, I must say that we are grateful. And we have stepped out and we have started the recovery. And it is going as planned. There is a website already that was up, and the persons can go on and they can register to mm-hmm. volunteer their service, and mm-hmm. they can register to give monetarily, or they can register to give some kind of relief products.
Well, that would have been the next question I was going to ask you. You know, what are some of the items or things that the Jamaicans need right now? Or you can give us the website. I think that will be easier, and we can check it out and see the list of items that are necessary.
All right. So, I know that I didn't have the name of the website, but if it is that we peruse the Government of Jamaica Office of Disaster Preparedness and Emergency Management, ODPEM for Jamaica, then that could take you to where it is that you can level the kind of support that you have for the country at this time. So if it is that you go to ODPEM, Office of Disaster Preparedness and Emergency Management.
Yes, go ahead.
You can register there to see how it is that you can make donations.
All right, donations, foodstuff, clothing, other items.
Right. There's a list of things that we can do with at this time. I know that certainly tarpaulins, because a lot of our houses have been totally demolished. Mm. And so those are some of the things. Food items, certainly, because, the persons are out of the ability to prepare. And in that part of the island, we would have lost the sources, the supermarkets, they have been emptied or they have been washed out.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things, they are needed at this time. The food supplies that shouldn't be too much.
Yeah, that's a priority. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. But things like blankets, beddings and so, mm-hmm. persons are really in need of those things, even as we, toiletries and so, people are really in need of those as they try to put back their lives together. But we can visit that site and then we can register and see how it is that we can give a hand so that we can, join with Jamaica to be on that road to recovery.
No problem. All right, well, we here at Freedom 106.5 FM and the Human Impact, we're thinking of doing a drive. Like I said to my listeners, during this week, we'll be, announcing exactly what we'll be doing, how we can, spearhead some relief efforts here from TNT to get to Jamaica. On that note, Dr. Robinson, thank you so much. I mean, even now, understanding the situation that Jamaica is in, for you to take the time to speak with us, I do appreciate you most generously. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you too. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to spend with you and to share with you. Mm-hmm. And I'm really thankful on behalf of Jamaica for just the thought and the thinking and the fact that, we're looking to put together something so that we can really experience what it is to be a community.
Mm-hmm.
Now is the time when we really experience these things. And so sometimes we take some things for granted,
like
water coming out of the top. We take it for granted sometimes.
And the shower. Yeah.
Just a cool drink of water. We take it for granted.
I mean, like I said, in these times, we really do acknowledge our blessings. Quickly, before you go, though, where is your book available? Is it just the Kindle edition, or is there like a paperback, just so that persons can know where they can get the book?
Right. So on Amazon, we have the paperback, the hardcover, and the Kindle edition. And if you ever visit Jamaica, there's a bookshop at the Norman Mandy International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
Books are there. And I'm just trying to see how I can get it in the wider Caribbean. But I know that in short order, we could work it out. It's just that my attention now is shifted a little bit to the recovery effort.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's no-brainer, but yeah.
But certainly, we're going to get it to saturate the Caribbean. Most certainly.
Well, take care and best of luck. And we will touch base again soon.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Take care.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.